One of the family.
The family. Dogs are a part of it and at the very heart of it. Nikki Campbell explores this wonderful world with the help of special guests and some other family members.
Welcome to One of the Family. My guest is Sarah Cox, one of our best DJs, finest broadcasters, nicest people, and greatest dog lovers. She understands her dogs intuitively, and they understand her completely.
They know when you laugh at them as well after a haircut. I've heard that a lot. And they get embarrassed. They're a bit like, all right.
They are. Dogs. They came from wolves or wolf-like creatures, evolved into the dogs we love and who love us. It's an incredible odyssey from tundra to sofa. And I'm proud to say that one of the leading researchers on this topic in the world, Krishna Varma from Stony Brook University, New York, tells us how the hell it happened. I love a bit of science.
Our common ancestor with a chimpanzee is about 6 to 8 million years. When was our common ancestor with the dog?
It's about 87 million years. Much further back. We're closer to a mouse than a dog.
Are we? Sarah Cox grew up on the family farm with animals all around, dogs and mice and others.
I've never been mad on geese. I think they're brilliant. We had 2 guard geese. Have you ever been chased by a goose?
Yeah, of course I have.
Of course I have. They're scary, aren't they? Because they just feel so unpredictable.
Yeah. I've also been attacked by a crow.
Oh, no, really? Go on.
Yeah, that's Hitchcock.
Horrible.
And I was walking Clapham Common, you know, the depths of the Amazon. And it just saw me. And it must have been the look after your young season. But no, you know, they're incredibly intelligent.
They're huge as well. They're like the size of a big Jack Russell or something like that. They're big.
Yeah, really. And I mean, they are huge and they're big and they're intimidating and they're dead smart. But they're incredible problem solvers. You know, they're up there with great apes and dolphins as the most intelligent animals in the animal kingdom. I think we come fourth. It was like pecking at my head. It was proper. Yeah, and I just ran. I just ran. It was terrifying. And it took me a couple of hours to calm down from it.
You weren't wearing your notorious bread beret that day, were you, Nick? Because I've told you, it's just not practical if you're walking in birded areas. That's scary. That is really, I mean, even we went to you know, when you get to an age where you go out and you take the dogs out and you take the kids, and the kids don't really understand the concept of a walk. They're just like, but where are we walking to? Doesn't matter where to, we're going for a walk. And so we do that, you know, odd weekends, we'll try and find them. And we live in London, which has got beautiful royal parks. It has got lovely parks. And we went, you know, around near Kensington Palace Gardens. They've got that lovely big pond there.
Nice.
And all those swans and geese and stuff, and my little city dogs who are just so excited that these birds are like running up to them, and I'm just, you know, I've got that, the memory of the geese of my childhood comes flooding back. Stay away from the geese.
But Steve Wright's on before you, before we leave geese.
Yeah, he's on 2 till 5, he's on with his big show.
Yeah. It's because, you know, I've known him forever.
Have you?
Because I was at Radio 1.
Well, from Radio 1,
I joined Radio 1 in 1987. And Steve was on there, and he used to have sound effects of geese. He'd be speaking, and then you get that. What do geese sound like? No, that's a seal. You know what I mean? That kind of.
Yeah, honk.
That kind of. Yeah, honk.
Get the geese off.
And that was one of his things. So when you see him, say hi, because I love Steve. Beautiful eccentricity. But when you see him, say hi, get the geese off.
Right? I'm going to tell him that because I'll see him this afternoon, although obviously now it's very socially distanced through lots of glass, like we're sort of being introduced slowly at a zoo or something. I used to have at Radio 1 gobbling geese, and the gobbling geese sound effect was that, and that was just gobbling geese, which I'd used occasionally. But that was on Radio 1. I think I was running out of ideas on the Radio 1 breakfast show. Although people loved it. I had the birthday pig, which was just a pig sound effect, played underneath birthday shout-outs. People went wild for it. If you need a new feature for your show, you're very welcome.
But, you know, it goes right back, just while we're on the subject of radio, animals in radio. This has taken a gloriously unexpected turn. But the very first DJ on Radio 1...
Tony Blackburn.
Flowers in the Rain. Mm. He had a character, because when I was growing up, I remember the Blackburn Breakfast Show. He had a character called Arnold, his dog, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm. No, was Arnold... Arnold was his dog, or was it a pretend character dog?
It was two woofs on a cartridge tape.
On a cartridge tape. That takes me back.
So he'd go, "What do you think, Arnold?" "Yeah, what do you think, Arnold?"
Bit of radio cheese, but I love a bit of cheese, closely related as I am to the mouse.
Growing up with dogs all around, do you remember those individual dogs and as a little girl going through the pain?
Well, what happened when we had loads of dogs growing up. A lot of them were on chains at the farm because they would just go off and kill cats or kill other dogs. They were beautiful with the humans, but they were kind of guard dogs. We had two dogs from the same litter, Spud and Carl. Yeah. And they were, I think they were collies crossed with big old lurchers. I mean, they seemed huge to me, but I've seen pictures since and I reckon they're about lurcher size, but I was obviously six or so, so they seemed massive to me. And legend had it that when they went, they would go up to the top field to the figure eight pond and lie down and die. Like, they'd just disappear and that's where they went.
Legend has it.
Yes. The legend of the dog by the figure eight pond, yeah. No, just as in, like, family legend. Like, that's what a couple of dogs did, I think, when they got really old. They just wandered off and went off to die. At home, it was much more, like... Basically, we'd have these lovely dogs with my mum and my stepdad. And we had, each time these pet dogs died, and I did love them, but I always wanted a puppy and I was never allowed a puppy because my mum was good friends with the woman at the local RSPCA. And the second she got whiff of the fact that our old dog had died, she was ringing my mum up saying, "There's this lovely dog, Jackie. And if he don't go to a home tomorrow, he's getting put down first thing." And my mum, of course, would be like, "Well, we've got to take him." So I was always I was always really sad when my dogs died. I was devastated. But there was always, because that's how kids are, there was always a little twinkle of hope that we'd replace the old one this time with a puppy. So even though I was really, really sad, I just wanted a puppy that would be really fun to replace the old dog. And it never happened because... lo and behold, we'd get this, like, you know, Heinz 57, very middle-aged dog had replaced the dog that had just gone. So I never got those, like, puppy years, you know, of sort of training or hanging out and just the sort of fun years. We always got the dogs when they were, you know, the equivalent of, like, you know, a 52-year-old man with aches and pains and not really, you know, who enjoys the dinner and a nice snooze and is quite flatulent.
So, that's me.
As I was saying that, I was thinking, oh, no, I'm describing our esteemed host here now. So... sadly, we always knew that... how we knew that the dog had died was that we'd get back... this happened, like, two or three times and just... really sad, just the collar would be on the kitchen table. I think Mum must have been at work, or I don't know if that was her way of, like, oh, if it was just a practical reason that they brought his collar and whacked it on the kitchen table, then she was back off out to work, which is fair enough. So I think as a teenager, it wasn't like the sit down and chat to us. In fact, we had one puppy before we had the train of middle-aged, quite old dogs. We did have a puppy at the very beginning and she got out and she got hit by a car and Mum was devastated. God. So maybe Mum was just, didn't want to get her heart broken again. So instead just picked up these sort of middle-aged scrubbing brushes that we just, you know, were just multicoloured, cute, you know.
It's funny because my mum, who we lost recently, was born in 1923 and she was 90... 7 months. She died still bright as a button end of last year. And she, her father was a chicken farmer, then a self-made milliner, and they lived in Harrogate. And so they sent her off to boarding school in a very kind of brutal way. And she came back from boarding school one day and found out that she couldn't see her dog Towser anywhere. And it was 2 days before her parents sort of casually mentioned, to ask them would have been impertinent. And eventually they just mentioned, or I think the cleaner or something mentioned that, oh yes, Towser ran into the traffic and died. And that was the brutal delivery of the news. Yeah, and she was telling me that story about 2 years ago. And she was at the kitchen table in Scotland and she told me the story and she turned into a little girl. Tell me about this dog you had, Snoop. Sounds just amazing. It sounds like the one of the loves of your life.
Snoop was awesome. I mean, he was like, the way I got him was like, it basically broke every rule book in the rules of how to be a responsible dog owner and research the breed and find reputable breeders. Like, it was terrible. So don't do it, kids. But I'd always had dogs, and when I moved to London, I really wanted a dog, and I thought, I can't have one until I own a house. I can't be in rented accommodation with a dog. It's not fair, and I obviously need a garden as well. So when I bought my first flat, I like picked up the keys on the Thursday or the Friday for this new flat in Kentish Town, northwest London. Picked up the keys on like the Friday. On the Saturday, I think it was, or maybe actually the Sunday, because we'd been out for a Sunday roast, I went and bought Snoop just like that, drop of a hat, from a pet shop. Mm. I'd had a couple of glasses of wine with this roast dinner. We picked up a little Basset Hound puppy, not done any research on the breed. And then on the Monday, I started like the Radio 1 breakfast show, like properly started it, because we did like a little pretend first show on the Friday. So as weekends go, that was quite a big weekend of taking on like my first mortgage, my first dog of my own, and hosting such a big show. So it was the only thing, it was the sort of thing you'd only do when you're like 28, because you have no fear. Like now, things like that would take like weeks and months of research and planning and being a grown up about it. But it turned out brilliantly. I mean, he, you know, I don't know how well bred he was, because I did have to have, he did have to have an operation. His elbow didn't fit into its joint properly, which apparently is quite common with Bassets. But he was a joy, and we had him for 13 years. He died just out there in the garden, underneath on a warm sunny day, and the sun was coming through the trees. And my lovely vet Josh, who I love, who's this Aussie guy, he came round. Snoop had been really ill for a couple of days, and he already had the thing in his paw, you know, so the cannula or whatever it is, so you could put drugs in there. And we just lay out in the dappily sunlight, and he left us, and the vet came around and put him to sleep, and it was a really lovely way to go. And me and my husband just cried like babies. I think it shocked my husband, who's not really a very animal-y person. I think it shocked him just how devastated he was. But he had a lovely life. 13's quite a good innings for a Basset. He saw a lot of change during his time, you know, because I went from, you know, by the time he left us, I had 3 kids. So, you know, he'd stationed himself every mealtime. He'd learnt that to be underneath a high chair is the place to be. And Bassett's very food driven. I mean, he was completely ruled by his belly. Some great stories of him eating like an entire like round sort of Christmas camembert thing at a friend's house once, because he wasn't very tall, but his back was so long that he was almost like go-go gadget dog, where he could put himself on his hind legs and like go and reach whatever he wanted to. And he got this cheese and wolfed the lot, then immediately vomited it up, and it sort of settled back into the same the same shape, knew it not.
Ate it again? Did he eat, did he eat the vomit?
He tried to start eating it. I got it off him. And a sprig of rosemary, it was good to go. Nobody was any the wiser. Snoop had died, and we said, you know, he died actually a couple of weeks or so before our wedding in 2013. We'd sort of said to the kids that he was having an operation and he might not make it through and stuff. And then after the wedding, like a week or so after, because it was so little, they were just like, you know, we said that he'd died and stuff and that it was fine. And they were okay. They were sad, but they were okay. Because towards the end, you know, he was just a big sleeping, snoring machine, really. We worried about for quite a bit. We'd think, you know, how is his health? Is he happy? Has he got quality of life? And sometimes he'd have a bad day. And we'd think, yeah, maybe he's on his way out. And we'd think about if it was time. And then the next morning, he'd literally be like, morning! What should we do today? Jazz hands. I'd be like, oh, God, you don't get it. And then he let us know by getting very, very ill all of a sudden, very quickly. So anyway, we were thinking, I was thinking we'll have to get another dog at some point. So a couple of months later or so, we started to think about it. Because I'd been on the farm, even though we had a terrier and a Jack Russell and stuff, I'd never had a dog that I could just really scoop up with one hand and like a little lap dog. Love the idea of that. So we went to the sort of meet dogs thing that they had on at an expo in London, at Earl's Court. I think it's called Meat Dogs, something like that. Anyway,
sounds like some terrible Chinese market, Meat Dogs.
No, it was really nice.
Oh.
Meat.
Clarification.
Meat, yeah, right. Yeah, sorry, meat with a double E.
Yeah.
So we went there and they had like dozens and dozens of breeders, all with their different dogs, and you could go around, and Lola, who must have been like 11 or whatever at the time, or 10, like cuddled every single animal in the building. Like literally, she was like, I've still not cuddled that one, and sent her over, and it'd be some sort of, you know, random breed. It was like, oh. That was like, I love it, cuddling it. And so at the end, we whittled it down, and we just thought that Maltese just sounded great. You know, they're easy to train, they don't shed, and they're happy, lovely, you know, loving little dogs. Don't need tons and tons of exercise. They're called an apartment dog, but I don't think there's any such thing as an apartment dog. I think every dog needs to be off a lead and running. So anyway, and I had a look through reputable breeders and all this, and found Kerrycrest up in Rotherham. And we chose Beano, and we got, and then I went back up there a few weeks later and picked him up, and he's just gorgeous. And then the campaign a year or so later, a couple of years later maybe, the campaign, slow and steady, drip, 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 to get dog number two began. And it was... We got Dolly about maybe 3 years later, I think.
And you know, you love them like you loved Snoop.
And we absolutely love them to bits. And you know, I think Maltese are really easy to love because they're pretty easy to train. You know, they just add so much to the family. Really affectionate and really, you know, and they. I know people are always like, oh, they've got such different personalities. But it's really amazing how they are just so different, these two little things. I mean, Beano always looks a little bit anxious, like he thinks somebody's talking about him. And he's got no reason to be anxious. He's perfectly happy. But he's always got this slight suspicion in his eyes. And I'm definitely his favourite. I'm mum to all of them because I'm in charge of feeding and I walk them the most. But he's definitely a bit of a mummy's boy. Dolly is obsessed with my husband Ben. I mean, she loves me, but I mean, she loves the kids as well. But she will sit and sniff his ears and try and just get a good slurp in his ears as often as she can. And she sits on his chest and just, she goes all dreamy when she looks at him.
I saw him a few minutes ago when we were setting the Zoom up, and I absolutely don't blame her at all. you know, but
I'll tell him that.
Yeah, please do.
And that previous point, Sarah is absolutely right. There is no such thing, he's banging the table, there's no such thing as an apartment dog. Dogs need to be out there sniffling and snuffling and running and playing. And even as my West Highland Terrier, Misty, occasionally does when she gets the opportunity, eating human... Wah, wah.
Where are you walking? Where are you walking your dog? It sounds horrible. There's people wildly defecating everywhere in your local park.
There's Clapham coming over that, and there's Wandsworth coming down that. And I've got to say, you get a better class of defecator on Wandsworth coming. You do. Do they smell nice? Slightly changing the subject. Do your dogs smell nice? Do you love the smell of dogs? I go all dreamy when I smell dogs, you know? And I saw a picture you had of one of your dogs in the bath the other day, and it was like just like one of my Westies when they rolled yeah. or something, and the hair's all down, and the eyes are completely massive, and they're looking up, and they're thinking, because my dog's thinking, do I like this or don't I like this? I'm not sure if I like this. Yeah. They quite like the warm water being of the shower head being sprayed all over them. They quite like that feeling.
Yeah, I try and make it as pleasant as possible, you know, the water to be
like
lovely and
day.
Warm, and yeah, like yeah. a spa day, it's a little massage. I mean, I must say, we had a friend round a few weeks ago who's got a puppy called Percy, who's like a Cavapoo, I think. And that puppy smell, you forget sort of warm, sweet, slightly malty sort of puppy smell. It's really unusual.
One of the family.
Oh, what a smell. Like a perfume. An expensive one too. Chanel de Chio. As you can hear, I've established what the French word for puppy is. I asked Kirsty Campbell her thoughts on puppy smells, and here is her dispatch from Bristol University.
Puppy smells are genuinely the best smells. Most comforting, cute, sweet smells in the world. You smell them and you get a sense of euphoria. Not euphoria, but like calmness. Just, oh God, take me back to that time when the puppies... You just have puppy smells, and I just sit with them and let them crawl on me. And just, oh my God.
Oh my God. Calm euphoria is exactly what it is, isn't it? I loved talking to Sarah Cox.
Been lovely chatting to you. I feel like you know what it's like when you're into animals. The second you get a chance to talk about your pets, you can't shut up. So sorry, I feel like I've really like wanged on, but it's been really lovely. Yeah. Just to talk about pets and how much we love them and how much they are a big part of the family. It's a really lovely thing to do, especially in these times. I could talk about them all day, I love them to bits. They don't ask anything of you, so when you're in quite a troubled state, the problem is that you feel guilt or you feel like you need to be a certain person for different people and to fulfil a role. And with an animal, you know, they don't ask that of you, they just want to be close and they'll just come and sit with you, and it's just... That sort of love, isn't it? It's so precious.
When I hear people speaking about animals with such love and passion, it gets to me every time. Please subscribe to One of the Family and like it and review it. You can get me on Twitter at One of the Family One, also Facebook and YouTube. There's fantastic stuff on YouTube. Full interview with Chris Packham, Ricky Gervais, Kevin Bridges. Some real gems. And thank you for listening to this episode. Dog evolution. Now, I tickled Maxwell's ears the other day when he was lying on the sofa, and I put the iPhone really close in. And after every delicate tickle, you can hear his groan of ecstasy. Here it is.
Good boy.
Oh, I love that boy. So how did we get to that gorgeous, lovable, loving creature from wolves? It's a fascinating story. I saw some real interesting papers that Krishna Varma, an academic, had written online. So I got in touch with him. I sought him and found him. And I said, look, will you come on the podcast to talk about this amazing story? He works at Stony Brook University, New York. Now, are you sitting comfortably? Prepare to be transported through time and listen to one of the greatest stories ever told.
This is taken from the common ancestor of the wolf and the dog. What, 20,000 years? It's not very long in the great scheme of things. This extraordinary transition and transformation. How did it happen?
I mean, it's probably somewhere in the order of 40 to 20,000 years ago. I would say that the best accepted theory of dog domestication prior to farming and all that kind of stuff, when we were still hunter-gatherers, we left a lot of refuse around camps and things like that. What we believe is those wolves that would essentially hang out around the camps and feed off the rubbish would essentially have a new food source, an easy food source, and that would give them a slight evolutionary advantage. And over time, they would get fitter and fitter. They'd become more interactive with humans. They would start to lose that fear. They also may have helped guard the area. And so we call this a commensal pathway for domestication. It's very, very passive on our part. It's not that, like, we bred wolves to become dogs, like we might have done with farm animals and things, dogs and sheep, where we would use them for food. It was very passive. And over time, just by these very small iterations of behavior, just getting a little bit closer each generation, they become part of the community. And then, but at this point, they're nothing like a Chihuahua. They're nothing like the dog you tend to have in your house. They're still kind of... the closest thing would be what we call village dogs today. You kind of see some dogs that kind of roam around. They don't live with people. But they're clearly... they're not like a wolf. They look like dogs. They can be friendly. They can be scared. That is probably what that early domesticate looked like. And probably for most of our history of interacting with dogs, they would have looked like these village dogs. It's only really, apart from maybe a few breeds in Asia, with the Victorian era, with the breeding, that you suddenly get this vast array of what we would call phenotypes, these kind of different shaped dogs, big, small, different colors and things like that. And really Victorian era breeding from the kennel clubs that gives you the Chihuahua and this very intense selective breeding. Now it becomes much more humans are taking dogs with certain traits and mating them together to get the thing that they want. But a very, very different process from that early domestication that occurred 20, 40,000 years ago. They have done this very cool experiment starting in the 50s by Dmitry Bilev. I don't know if you know about this, the foxes. They would, over time, see which of these Arctic foxes, silver foxes, were tamer, and they would basically give them a score for how tame they were, how likely they were to come to the investigator and not be scared versus those that would be far away and be aggressive. And then they would give them a final score when they're kind of ready to breed, and then take just the tame ones and put them together. And then over generations, they essentially make what you would say are almost like dogs. They're very domesticated now. You can see them on videos and their behavior is fully domesticated, very friendly. But it's a very different scenario because they're just very small little foxes. You can kind of get away with that kind of process. It's also a smaller generation time. So you can do everything in a very compressed time. It's very difficult for me to imagine we could have actively taken kind of wolf cubs and bred them to be dogs. To me, and I think most researchers, the kind of in more... passive way of domestication, at least getting them to a point where they're much less fearful, much less aggressive, and much better at picking up our cues as well. And that's a big part of being a dog compared to wolf, is picking up human cues.
I think it's been described as the survival of the friendliest, this process. Isn't it? Why do they change physically? Because this is at the heart of things. This is This is your wolf to chihuahua and your selective breeding, which is a hugely contentious area in itself. But why do they look different? What's going on in the genes?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting... I mean, that fox experiment tells us actually a lot. Mm. Through the process of getting more domesticated, you do see all the telltale signs of what we call domestication syndrome. So you start to get floppy ears, you start to get curly tails, you get this kind of patchier fur.
Was that an intentional pun, by the way, telltale signs? Because if it was, it was a very, very...
I didn't mean to do that, but yes, that's pretty good. But there are all these features that just seem to be part of the package of domestication. Dogs just have everything. They are the archetypal example of what happens when you have domestication and you have all the features that you'd associate it. And one of the theories, and we have a little bit of work from looking at genetics that point to this, is this what we call the neural crest hypothesis. Mm. The big part of domestication is this idea that you're less aggressive to humans. And so how do you avoid essentially the fight or flight response? And what you probably want to do is lower your adrenaline. And that, if you can lower that adrenaline in an animal, you can probably make them a little bit more amenable to not run away from you or fight you and just kind of just be comfortable around you. How can we lower adrenaline? One way is to essentially make the adrenal gland smaller, the actual tissue that's making adrenaline over time. It turns out the adrenal gland, when it's first being made during the development process, very early on, it's part of this neural crest, which actually is responsible for a whole host of other parts of the body development very early on, including ears, facial, fur. Even though we're trying to reduce the adrenal gland, to do that, we actually have to touch upon genes that will affect other parts of the body.
Absolutely fascinating. So where does the friendliness come from? Is that something to do with what's going on in the neural crest?
That may be something that's that is probably a little further along. So once they've reduced that fear, there may be other genetic changes involved, brain formation and behavior, but it probably needs that early change in the fight or flight response to allow that to happen. So you can't just change the brain of a dog to suddenly be friendly. You need that early foundation of not running away or not ripping our face off or whatever that may be. So a very cool element that we see in terms of human and dog evolution. Once we develop farming in the Neolithic, depending on where you are, around 7,000 years ago, we suddenly start to eat a lot of starch. We have a gene called amylase. If you look at other primates, we have two copies, one that you get from your mother, one you get from your father. But in humans, and it seems very much guided by whether you're in a kind of agricultural society, we've developed multiple other copies of this same gene, amylase, which then gives us a much better possibility of digesting starch. We're producing more amylase protein, the enzyme, so we can just take in more starch, digest it into sugars, and so it can be useful. So that's part of cereals and all that kind of element. Turns out dogs have developed the exact same change at pretty much the same time, and they're one of the only species that have that. They have this amylase gene, and when you look at dogs, at about the same time, they seem to develop extra copies of this amylase gene so that they also can digest starch so they can eat the same kind of foods that we are eating. If you look at wolves, you know, dingoes, they don't have that change because that's not what they're not part of that co-evolution process.
So they change genetically because the ones who could eat the starch were more likely to survive.
If you imagine dogs are living around us when we start developing farming, we're producing all this cereal. What food are they going to give the dogs to eat? It's probably going to be the same kind of material, maybe the leftovers. So the ability for that dog to be able to digest starch in an effective manner is going to give it a huge advantage over those dogs that cannot digest starch, and that will have the knock-on effects over generations.
So some dogs will have been done in by starch.
Or they essentially may not have been able to digest it very well. They produce less puppies because of that. Mm.
So when's the earliest evidence of our relationship being one of companions?
The skeleton of two individuals with a dog in Germany called von Oberkassel, 14,000 years ago, I would say is the best evidence of dogs, and they're buried with two people, probably as a kind of a pet.
Good boy. Good boy.
Dogs have a little bit more of a kind of forehead to their skulls and the teeth. There's fewer teeth and there's crowding. And the head just get a little, everything just gets a little smaller. Domestication generally involves the animal getting smaller. The brain is a big thing. The brain tends to get smaller in domesticated animals. And so, I mean, wolves are incredibly smart compared to probably a normal dog.
Isn't it incredible that, you know, you could still technically breed a Chihuahua with a wolf and that would still work, and you would get a functional, fertile, fecund canine at the end of it. Obviously, the Chihuahua would have to be the father. Great. Do you like dogs?
Yeah.
One of the family.
Krishna Varma of Stony Brook University, New York. Isn't that great? I love that stuff. Well, Maisie is one of the family. She's the daughter, the West Highland Terrier daughter. Her mother is Misty. Maisie was born here in this house. We had that puppy smell in abundance. Now, she really is one of the family, far more so than any of the mice that come in here uninvited. And here she is on the carpet with me, playing with her toy.
One of the family.
Another run out. Any excuse for some radio days, thanks to Sarah Cox, Radio Royalty, and thanks to you for listening. Thank you.